Russian Orthodoxy and Initiation. Author, Alexander Dugin. Translator, J. Farnold. Chapter 8 of Mysteries of Eurasia, Moscow, Arctogea, 1991. Our study of the sacred geographical layout of Russia and in a broader sense Eurasia has led us to the necessity of considering the purely religious aspect of Russian uniqueness, that is, the aspect directly connected to the Orthodox Church in which one of the most important elements of the identity of continent Russia is concentrated. The vastness of such a topic compels us to choose but the single layer of the problem and determine an angle that will form the basis of our study. We believe that the most essential and most interesting perspective would be a consideration of the specificity of Russian Orthodoxy in the context of René Guénon's works. In order to accomplish this, or, more precisely, in order to lay the groundwork for such an approach which would offer unlimited possibilities for a deep and unexpected understanding of Russian Orthodoxy, we must first briefly outline Guénon's most important propositions in regards to exotericism, esotericism, initiation, and counter-initiation. Basing ourselves on these provisions, we can then better and more clearly grasp the secret of Russia and the meaning of its historical mission. Religion and initiation according to Guénon. According to Guénon, tradition, the entirety of sacred knowledge dating back to the primordial and inhuman divine source, has, in this final period of our cycle, the Kali Yuga, which has already been counting down for several millennia, been divided into two parts, exotericism and esotericism. Exotericism can manifest itself in the form of religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or in a non-religious form, Hinduism, Confucianism, Buddhism, etc., and represents the socio-psychological, ordering aspect of tradition, that is, the face of tradition oriented exclusively outwards toward people and made available to all members of traditional society without exception. Esotericism, for its part, is the purely spiritual sphere. On this level, tradition appeals to the elite and the chosen who have been called to go deep into sacred doctrines and myths. Esotericism is the underside of tradition, while exotericism remains the outer side. Religious society conventionally has two types of rituals intended for the initiation of the neophyte into the bosom of the sacred. The first is acceptance into an exoteric organization, conversion, and the second is initiation, this time into an esoteric organization. Initiation is the foundation of esotericism, and in certain cases it can be constructed not only as a ritual, but also a complex of associated esoteric and symbolic doctrines, or even as a manifestation of concrete spiritual influences exceeding the scope of the outer, exoteric tradition. According to Guénon, the existence of precisely such a dual structure in traditional society is a necessary condition for any society to be considered normal and fully fledged. The uniqueness of Christianity. Such a schematic presentation, however, requires special explanation in regards to the Christian religion. Guénon believed that the Christian tradition, unlike Judaism and Islam, was originally incomplete, possessing only an esoteric and initiatic level. As evidence of this is cited the absence of any consideration in the New Testament of any legal or social dimension, which constitutes the essence of any exotericism. Only in later years did Christianity descend to the exoteric level in adopting the socio-religious basis of the revised code of Roman law. This original and essential esotericism of the Christian tradition should be borne in mind in order to understand further considerations. The Shiite problem through the lens of Henry Corbin. The image of tradition as divided into internal and external spheres is particularly inapplicable in the special case of Shiism and the Islamic tradition. The most authoritative Western scholar of Islam, Henry Corbin, pointed out this very interesting feature of Iranian Islam, which is by and large Shiite. On the one hand, Shiite Islam is replete with numerous explicit references to esotericism and the foundation of Shiite doctrine rests on the recognition of the central place of the light of the Imamate and the sacred mission of Ali, the first of the Imams whose figure corresponds to the deeply esoteric level of the Muslim religion. On the other hand, Sufi initiatic organizations are least widespread of all in Shiism. Corbin asserts that Shiite Sufism is a rare encounter and, thus, Shiite Islam does not comply with the norm of the strict division of tradition into external and internal planes, as is the case in Sunni Islam. Ghanan himself, however, recognized that Iranian Islam was a special phenomenon, and he associated its lack of bans on the depiction of humans or animals in sacred art, such bans are strictly observed in Sunni Islam, with the specific Aryan origin of the Iranians who, in comparison to Semites, are much less inclined toward idolatry. In Shiism, and particularly in Iranian Shiism, we are thus dealing with an esoteric tradition more open and less formalized or institutionalized than at Tasawwuf and Sufism. In the case of extreme Shiism, Islamism, this is totally evident given the virtual absence of any exotericism at all. It should also be noted that the Iranians occupy the more eastern geographical and intellectual regions of the Islamic Ummah, or in more general terms the Caliphate. Let us recall the Oriental Theosophy of Suhrawardi. Orthodoxy and the East. Taking the above-mentioned into account, an analogy can be suggested between Catholicism and Sufism on the one hand and Orthodoxy and Shiism on the other. Firstly, unlike in Catholicism, it is practically impossible to record any special esoteric organizations in the history of the Eastern Church, whether Hermetic orders, companionships, or Gnostic brotherhoods. Despite their absence, however, the esoteric underpinnings of Orthodoxy can be clearly traced and are evident in the sacred architecture of churches, initiatic iconography, and a widespread apophatic theology, which was practically erased by exoteric Catholicism with the introduction of the dogma of the filioque, as well as in the monastic contemplative practices in Hesychasm, the Old Believers, and the traditions of the Holy Fools, etc. Secondly, Orthodoxy never evolved into a purely social religion, but remained above this level. The Orthodox Patriarch, unlike the Pope, is first and foremost the spiritual center of the Church, who does not directly influence public and political life. The social role of the Roman Pope was indeed the subject of severe criticism of Catholicism expressed by the Orthodox. It can be said that this descent of Christianity into society in the West never happened in the East. In some sense, the Gibelin archetype was realized in Russia with the sacred emperor as the center of the state and the patriarch fulfilling strictly sacred functions. Thirdly, this Gibelin archetype mentioned above was embodied in the sacred attitude towards the Russian Tsars. It was the Tsar who was the sacred center of the Russian imperial ecumene in whose figure were concentrated all of the immanent religious energies of the empires, peoples. Unlike Catholic eschatology, in which the anti-pope and the usurpation of the throne of Saint Peter are discussed in an apocalyptic sense, Orthodox prophecies never mentioned an anti-patriarch. Instead, all negative, counter-sacred forces are gathered in the singular personage of the anti-tsar, the Antichrist Emperor. In principle, this Gibelin aspect is typologically close to the Shiite understanding of the sacred nature of authority, as Shiite doctrine, unlike Sunni, insists on the rule of only the Alamites, the sacred descendants of the first of the Imams. The Shiites believe that no one outside of this line has any sacred or initiatic right to rule. Fourthly, the eastern geographical location of Russian Orthodoxy logically puts it in close proximity to the lines of the Eastern Fathers, that is, the saintly fathers from Greece, Anatolia, Syria, Lebanon, Cappadocia, etc. Fifthly, the tradition of Hesychasm, or light gnosis from the first anchorites in the Athos monastery was not the product of some kind of formal organization within the framework of Russian Orthodoxy. Hesychasm literally permeates the Orthodox tradition all the way to the point of its external aspects. Of course, the division between internal and external aspects remained, but there have never existed any structural differences between the Hesychasts and Old Believers on the one hand, and the clergy and believers on the other. This differs from the strict organization of initiatic orders in Catholicism, where this border is clearly marked. Sixthly and finally, The esoteric specificity of Orthodoxy has been preserved in church ritual itself and particularly in the presence of iconostasis, which separates the altar of the sacrament from the laity. Catholic ritual involves the openness of the altar, its accessibility to viewing by all the laity at any time during service and outside of it. Thus, the sacrament of the altar is genuinely exoteric and descends to the outer level. In Orthodoxy, however, the gates of iconostasis, the royal gates, are open only for a short period during the key moments of the liturgy, the exception being on certain holidays. This symbolizes the unique revelation of the apophatic, unknowable principle on the other side of the cataphatic vision of the sacred world, which in a normal state is presented only by symbols, the images of iconostasis, the desis near, etc., as if they replace the altar. This unique feature of Orthodox ritual is connected to the historical absence of a developed scholastic and rational theological tradition in Russia, as theology itself in the Orthodox Church relates to the initiatic and super-rational level, whereas the openness of the altar in the Catholic Church relates the sacrament to the sphere of the rational and dogmatic. When the Catholic believer is in search of initiation, he must to appeal to special non-church authorities, esoteric societies, brotherhoods, associations, etc., but the Orthodox can attain such as desired in the liturgy itself and enter into the most profound transcendent dimension without the aid of other sacred institutions. Thus, it should be grasped that the Orthodox Church, similarly to the Shiite trend in Islam, is not subject to the strict division into exoteric and esoteric levels, this being true at least on the level of its archetypal organization of the sacred system. However, this does not mean that all of Orthodoxy is esoteric or that all the Orthodox are esotericists. Without a doubt, the division of internal and external planes is maintained in Orthodoxy as it is everywhere else, depending on the personal qualities and spiritual caste of this or that human being. However, in our case, this division is not formalized, and the degree of initiatic quality depends exclusively on the internal nature of the believer and his efforts to realize his given spiritual possibilities. Of course, the degree of spiritual realization strictly corresponding to the general structure of the initiatic sphere is preserved in Orthodoxy, but its character is more flexible and less structured than it is in closed esoteric organizations. The question of virtual initiation. Speaking of initiation, Ganon distinguished between virtual initiation and effective or realized initiation. From his point of view, the Christian religion, since becoming exoteric, cannot offer any sort of initiation. In Catholic ritual and in the Catholic sacrament, purely spiritual energies of the same nature as in initiatic rituals are also in action, but they are not oriented towards perfect interiorization and, consequently, affect only the outer side of the individual structure of believers. Salvation is guaranteed, but the path to higher, super-individual levels of existence is not opened as happens in purely esoteric mysteries. An initiation received by means of esotericism might remain a forever virtual, untapped possibility if there is a lack of knowledge of the secrets of the initiatic work, the great work, or if the initiated prefers to use the wealth attained for goals opposite to the great goal of spiritual exaltation and the realization of purely heavenly, spiritual states. Orthodox initiation. Building on the particularities of the Orthodox tradition and basing ourselves on the typological parallel with the Shiite tradition, an extremely important conclusion can be drawn. Orthodoxy is an operative instrument for transferring virtual initiation. Thus, Orthodox ritual itself, unlike Catholic ritual, preserves an initiatic character peculiar to original Christianity. On the symbolic level, the Church of St. Andrew the First called the Orthodox Church never fully separated itself from the esoteric Church of St. John, as happened in the case of the Church of St. Peter. In addition, the medieval legend of the kingdom of Prester John located somewhere in the east can be symbolically related not only to the main sacred center of the primordial tradition, but also by analogy to Russia itself where, in fact, John, Ivan, Ion, has always been the most widespread name. This particularity and uniqueness of Russian Orthodoxy has its doctrinal reflection in the Orthodox formula of faith, in which the rejection of the Catholic innovation of the filioque, that is, the assertion that the Holy Spirit comes not only from the Father, the first entity of the Trinity, but also from the Son, the second entity, bears the character of a rejection of mediating entities between the sacred, spiritual cosmos, the Holy Spirit, and the Genesis. In other words, it rejects exotericism as a mediating force between the believer and initiation. The omnipresence of the Holy Spirit and its direct link to the Father, along with the apophatic hypostasis of the Trinity, means a direct totality of the spiritual light accessible to the Orthodox, which permeates being in every sense and opens the initiatic dispensation in Orthodox life. This Orthodox principle of divine house-building, which is central to the entire Eastern Church and its practices, precisely corresponds to the church-building line of Western Christian initiation pronounced in the sphere of special non-church organizations of the initiatic type later concentrated in Christian masonry and companionships. Such an initiatic phenomenon in Orthodoxy, and especially the absence of the filioque, explained the fact that, unlike Catholic esotericism, in Orthodoxy there are no traces to be found of Hermeticism as a separate and independent discipline. As a sacred cosmology, Hermeticism actually focuses on the consecration of the sacred cosmos, the realm of the Holy Spirit, as the direct product of the Father, that is, in the forthright godlikeness of the cosmos, the theophany of the cosmos, free from the passage of the censorship of Logos. If in full-fledged theology the Logos Son is naturally shifted onto the supra-individual level that is transcendental in relation to the human mind, then in terms of the degeneration of theological consciousness, this hypostasis of the Holy Trinity is in danger of being identified with the human mind, which is precisely what happened in Catholic theology, beginning with the exclusion of the apophatic approach. This reaches its conclusion with rationalism and humanism of a semi-profane character. Orthodox doctrine, by virtue of its natural, informal Hermeticism, did not undergo a similar transformation and has preserved its initiatic, super-individual and super-rational nature. Here it should be noted that there is a second, equally troubling aspect of the arrangement under examination. Being common to the entire people without strict division into elite and common forms of spirituality, the Russian Orthodox Church is also faced with the risk of offering mere virtual initiation, albeit of a different type than that in the Catholic tradition. In the majority of cases, the virtual initiation afforded by Orthodoxy to all Christians can fail to be taken to its logical conclusion in the form of a positive and final goal, which, on the one hand, is totally understandable taking into account the necessary difference between the inert nature of people and the overall exclusivity of a fully fledged initiatic path. There are many called, but very few chosen. On the other hand, however, this orientation towards the superpersonal or beyond personal aspects of apophatic Orthodox theology serves almost exclusively the discursive and rational forms of initiatic doctrines, sometimes extremely important at the preparatory stage. Thus, the realization of virtual initiation gradually becomes more and more problematic. Of course, the chosen, the saints, the elders, and the monks, or any simply exceptional personalities, can indeed reach the end of this path, but the majority are compelled to limit themselves to mere virtual initiation. Such a stipulation especially explains the phenomenon of the widespread tradition of holy fools in Rus, that is, those people who have acquired the opportunity of spiritual contemplation, but are incapable of harmoniously combining it with the normal functioning of the individual, rational level of their personality. On the other hand, holy foolishness, as a phenomenon of Russian spirituality, is a particularly telling aspect of Russian Orthodoxy, which once again confirms the Eastern Church's initiatic nature. After all, without any special initiation, no holy fools would have existed. The difficulty associated with the complete realization of virtual initiation, however, is thus quite clear. The dark mystery of cosmism. When René Guénon spoke of counter-initiatic organizations of the West, he of course did not put quotation marks around the issue, as the very nature of this topic demands certain precautions. After all, if one summits all of what Ganon said on this question, including in the form of innuendos and assumptions, the following picture unfolds. In the past centuries, counter-initiation has manifested itself all the more clearly in the degraded initiatic organization of the Hermetic type in the West. This can refer to the offshoots of Masonry as well as Neo-Rosicrucianist or Neo-Alchemical organizations. These groups, which inherited the secrets and rituals of virtual initiation, gave rise to a whole range of pseudo-initiatic occult and theosophist societies in the 19th century, which later formed the basis of what has come to be called neo-spiritualism, Ganon-ranked magnetism, spiritism, the theosophism of Madame Blavatsky and Besant, the occultism of Pippus, the anthroposophy of Steiner, and all the extensions and variations of such neo-mysticist and pseudo-esoteric trends as neo-spiritualisms. Today the majority of such neo-spiritualist organizations are united under the sign of the syncretic New Age movement. Neo-spiritualism itself is not directly counter-initiatic, but is an instrument aimed at the destruction of the remnants of the true tradition in the West under the guise of a return to spirituality, which in turn leads the profane into the abyss of dissolution and psychic chaos. In turn, counter-initiation belongs to a much deeper level of reality, being associated with what has been called the devil's mission. René Ganon considered the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor to be one of the most dangerous counter-initiatic organizations. The line is drawn from this to all the more massive neo-spiritualist tendencies, including even those sometimes opposed to its teachings, such as Theosophism, Occultism, Perverted Neo-Hinduism, Arivil, Sri Aurobindo Ghosh, and others. It is extremely telling that the doctrine of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor was called the Cosmic Philosophy, the Cosmic Doctrine, or sometimes Cosmism. The essence of the Cosmism of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor consists of contact with the cosmos or cosmic consciousness, which means the attainment of the light nature of the cosmos. The light theme is embodied in the very name of the order, Luxor, the Egyptian city whose name is similar to the Latin word lux or light and the name Lucifer, or Lightbringer. The cosmic doctrine concentrates all attention on the psychic or subtle plane, practically identifying the spiritual and the superpsychic with that of the soul or mental element. This is not a special form of philosophically abstract pantheism, but the magical, concrete, operative and aggressive one. Besides actually ignoring the transcendental aspects of the spirit, the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor's Cosmism also threatened transferring many initiatic sacred and spiritual symbols and rituals to the mental and material level, which entails a parodying of true initiation, and its grotesque and dangerous imitation. The members of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, possessing indisputable paranormal capabilities, were not only the first to formulate the foundations of neo-spiritualist theories, but also, through provoking mysterious phenomena, achieved their speedy introduction into the most diverse cultural and scholarly environments. Historically, the roots of this secret society date back to several German Masonic lodges of the 18th century in which the members of the highest degree practiced operative magic. Roots can also be traced back to the unconventional masonry of the Egyptian Rite, the Memphis Mizraim, and the sexual magic groups of Randolph, which displayed considerable satanic characteristics. In fact, the cosmism of the counter-initiatic Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor was later inherited by openly satanic centers such as the Order of the Templars of the Orient, OTO, of Kalner, and Aleister Crowley, who called himself the Beast of 666. If we turn to Russia in the second half of the 19th century, we discover a quite striking phenomenon which was called Russian Cosmism, whose most famous representative was Nikolai Fedorovich Fedorov, the author of the famous work The Philosophy of the Common Cause. In Fedorov's biography there is no mention of any contact with counter-initiatic organizations, but his works remain a compendium of counter-initiatic doctrines that almost exactly match those of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor. Fedorov even maintained the theory of artificially resurrecting the dead, which tradition considers to be an outspoken sign of the kingdom of the Antichrist. In addition, Fedorov's ideas to a certain extent formed the paradigm for the transfer of spiritual, symbolic, and religious doctrines to the psychic materialist level. Among these we find the theories of the management of atmospheric phenomena, the conversion of churches into museums, and, finally, the project for establishing a universal and indivisible human brotherhood to include all the resurrected love of the ancestors and become the crown of history. Fedorov's moral utopianism and pantheistic messianism inspired a number of Russian philosophers, scholars, writers, and theoreticians and, what's more, his cosmism was extremely popular in Bolshevik circles, who identified the brotherhood of the risen and resurrected, sick, with communism. In some sense, the ideas of Fedorov reflected the exalted revolutionary messianism of the era. However, Fedorovist cosmism in fact possesses a purely orthodox Christian form which was not the only, although perhaps the most striking, manifestation of counter-initiatic cosmism in Russia. In a broader sense, Russian cosmism can be called a clearly formulated tendency of orthodox virtual initiation which, if we recall its universal nature ensured by the mere fact of confessional belonging, was realized not by means of positive ascent from the mental world to the purely spiritual, heavenly, super-individual one, but by means of fusing with the intermediately psychic world, that is, the thin cosmos. This cosmicist specificity of natural Russian counter-initiation negatively reflected the issue of the filiac, for if the path from the spiritual universe, from the cosmos of the Holy Spirit to the apophatic principle of the Father itself is not completed, then no mere rational or formalized structures can hold back individual beings from fusing with the subtle plane and immersing in the chaos and excitement of what tradition calls the lower waters. Russian cosmism is thus the ultimate form of degradation of the Orthodox holy fooldom, a demonic form of this foolishness in which the holy fools of Christ become the holy fools of the Antichrist. It is this character of cosmism which sharply distinguishes practically all of Russian philosophy, science, and culture from European profanity, as cosmicist consciousness is drawn specifically to the non-rational, paradoxical, and powerful note of subtle energy which breaks through the structure of logical constructions. If in Russia in the 20th century the most heinous persecution of the Church was indeed carried out under the communist regime, then we should see in this the natural counter-initiation of the Orthodox nation deprived of its vertical, holy perspective which, for lack of rational, logos-related boundaries, lapsed into the extreme forms of demonic, aggressive, and anarchic cosmicist foolishness, and above all the foolishness of the Antichrist. Conclusion. The unique features of the Russian Church and its specificity which we have broken down might help understand the bizarre and strange world of the Russian conscience, which is similar neither to Western nor to Eastern forms. In his book East and West, Ganon identified the Russians as a people which imitates the archetypes inherent to the truly Eastern peoples. In another place, he noted how occultist and spiritualist practices are widespread in Russia, something which he saw as evidence of Russian special propensity for psychism. Finally, he put forth the quite mysterious statement that Russian communism is most likely something other than what it is commonly believed to be. Despite their criticality, these assessments indeed very fairly describe this orthodox people, whose true spiritual elite, albeit too small and too weak, pushed virtual initiation to the point of universality, while at the lowest levels it is as if the masses imitated the possession of the true spiritual mystery of the East. Perhaps the Russian idea of sobornost, Catholicity, and universality, such as that of the Slavophiles, and later the communists and socialists' idea of universal equality were in fact the expressions of a vague consciousness of the general initiation of the nation, its universal brotherhood. Indeed, members of esoteric organizations call each other brothers as do lodges, orders, and monastic communities. It also cannot be excluded that the Bolshevik Revolution was an explosion of part of this justified conviction of universal initiation seeking to cancel the exoteric hierarchy, the master system, as something unnecessary and vicious imposed by the alien West, the Grand Inquisitor of Dostoevsky, and as a social filioque which remain a barrier between the people and the light cosmos of the Holy Spirit. But properly speaking, these same tendencies, only on a closed, conspiratorial level, also enlivened the majority of counter-initiatic organizations which were not only anti-Catholic but also foreign to the socialist and communist pathos. For example, Theodore Roos, who initiated Aleister Crowley, the Beast of 666, into esotericism, was a known anarchist and socialist. However, in no other country or region of the earth have such counter-initiatic, thoroughly cosmicist, and mystical communist trends manifested themselves to such an extent as in Russia, which for more than 70 years became the epitome of the Red Woman of the Apocalypse, the Whore of Babylon. But even long before this period, in the dark political mysticism and plotting of the Time of Troubles, coupled with the succession of the imposters, in the grandiose stagings of the apocalypse by the sinister Emperor Peter I, in the grotesque parody of the Russian Enlightenment of the time of Catherine and, finally, in the disturbing and psychedelic literature, Gogol, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Sologub, and philosophy, Komiakov, Solovyov, Rozanov, etc., of Russia, the sprouts of the red cosmos sowed by the virtual initiation of Russian Orthodoxy matured and produced flowers that pointed not upwards towards the sun of Russian holiness, the spiritual son of Sergei Radonezhsky, Nilsorsky, and Seraphim Sravsky, but downwards. The current state of Russia cannot be defined in purely economic or political terms. The seeds of virtual initiation, it should not be forgotten that even under the communist dictatorship the majority of Russians baptize their children, are too significant and active to expect any kind of transformation of Russia into a purely secular, capitalist, or a profane state of the Western model. The roots of the Russian phenomenon are too deep and tragic to count on such an outcome. The Russian soul and, more precisely, the complexity of those Russians virtually initiated who form the mystical body of the inner church cannot abandon their initiatic and crucial function. Either there will be a catastrophe even more frightening and profound than under communism or, contrary to all external circumstances, a spiritual elite will appear which will halt the rapid decline into the abyss, instantly casting the nation of the Red Beast into the spiritual heavens of the Holy Trinity much like Christ himself, freeing old Adam from the snares of hell. If the possibility of salvation still exists for our counter-initiatic civilization, then does initiatic Orthodox Russia not remain the best place for ascension?